Blog Talk Radio.
Let's have problems in broomsticks and ghosts. Cousins of witches with all of their hosts. You may think they scare me, you're probably right. Blood cats and goblins on Halloween night. Trick or treat!
You're about to enter the portals of Movie Geek Heaven. It's another exciting episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, from writer-director Rob Zombie's eagerly anticipated remake of Halloween, producer Malika Kod. Plus, he's played the young Mel Gibson in What Women Want, starred opposite Jim Carrey in The Number 23, and now he's saddled up to portray Christian Bale's son in the upcoming western 310 to Yuma, actor Logan Lerman. Got a question for the geeks or any of tonight's guests? Give us a call at 718-508-9477. Now, sit back, strap in, and get ready to get your geek on. Here are your hosts for Movie Geeks United, Jamie, Chris, and Jerry.
Thank you, Tiffany. This is Movie Geeks United. Welcome to another exciting Wednesday night episode. My name is Jamie, and we have Jerry here as well.
Hey, how's everyone doing tonight?
Hello, Jerry.
Hello, Jamie.
Chris will not be joining us tonight. He'll be back with us on Sunday. But taking his place this evening is film critic and journalist extraordinaire Aaron Adadiaz. How are
hello,
you, Aaron?
Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good to be back.
We have a great show for you tonight. And actually, we have some great guests in the upcoming weeks, too. We're pretty much completely booked for the next 2 weeks. And we're going to make some announcements later on in the show, including one very exciting announcement that from a guest that just confirmed about an hour ago. And it could be the ultimate untapped Hollywood insider, I think. So any guesses, guys?
I have some, but I'm just going to keep my mouth shut.
Well, I thought Army Archer, but then I remembered he retired. So.
Yeah. So it's not Army Archer, but good guess.
That's a great guess, though.
Yeah, that would be. So we'll be making those announcements later on in the show. And just a couple of programming notes. You can subscribe to our show by iTunes if you click on the subscribe by iTunes icon on the right-hand side of the Blog Talk Radio screen, and where you can find some of our great past shows, like our interview with composer and editor John Ottman from the Berlin set of the new Bryan Singer Tom Cruise film Valkyrie, our Blair Witch Project reunion, just a host of great shows, the character actor tribute that we just did on Sunday evening. They're all terrific shows, and I really urge you to do that. It's completely free to do so. So got a great show tonight. Are you guys all set and ready to go?
I'm primed.
Okay.
I'm excited.
Let's get this thing started. In 1978, a little movie called Halloween single-handedly revolutionized the popularity and appreciation of the horror genre and gave birth to a stunningly successful franchise of frightening films. Under the guidance of master director John Carpenter and multi-talented director and producer Mustafa Akkad, that little film that could became the little film that did, eventually going on to become one of the highest-grossing independent films of all time. In fact, any list of the greatest horror films ever made is incomplete without Halloween resting at the very top. Mustafa continued to invest in the franchise throughout the years leading up to his untimely passing in 2005, but the producing torch was passed on to his son, Malik, who has been instrumental in revitalizing the genre and the Halloween series through his invaluable contributions on the last four installments. This latest installment, written and directed by the spectacular filmmaker Rob Zombie, brings the series and Akkad's legacy full circle as it delivers an altogether fresh and terrifying remake to that classic 1978 film. Tonight, we are honored to be joined by Mr. Malik Akkad, just 2 days shy of the release of his eagerly anticipated film. Mr. Akkad, are you there?
I am.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's
thanks for having me. What an intro. Just want to let you know it's pronounced Malik. So,
oh, it's Malik. I'm so sorry.
No problem, but that was very nicely said. That
well,
nice
intro. Thank you
it's
so
a
much
pleasure
for, doing our show.
For you to be here. Thank you.
So I'm speaking with Jamie.
This is Jamie, and then we have Jerry. Say
hi
Jerry.
And hey, Jerry. Okay.
And then we have Aaron.
And Aaron, okay.
Yeah. First of all, this must be an exciting time for you. You're 2 days out from this release. It's one of the most anticipated movies. I cannot wait to see it.
That's great. It is.
What's the time like for you?
Well, we've been working on this film for 4 years, this installment anyway, well before Rob was involved. It was sort of just the untitled Halloween project.
Yeah.
And so when we finally did get Rob involved about a year and a half ago, things really started moving. And when we shot that first frame of film, I can't tell you how good it felt. Mm-hmm. And then to wrap it and to have the premiere last Thursday, which was incredible. So really, it's just been sort of milestone after milestone. And day after tomorrow, it will hit the theaters.
It's going to be huge.
I hope so.
It's a given. So was the plan always to kind of to do a kind of a redo of the original? Or
no, actually, we were contemplating doing just a regular sequel. And, at the time, my late father was working with us as the executive producer.
Mm-hmm.
And we went through three different drafts and three different sets of writers, and we couldn't really get something that we were all excited about. I mean, to do a part nine, mm-hmm. you've got all these different storylines, and it gets a bit convoluted to try and answer them all and get something fresh. So, and needless to say, as you mentioned, his untimely death sort of stalled the process a little bit. So then when we finally got back together, Bob Weinstein and I, we sort of wanted to do something that was really bigger than we had originally anticipated. So we thought, well, maybe the time is right to start again and to do a remake.
Sure, yeah.
And the idea was, I told him, well, that sounds great to me, but it's really got to be someone special, you know.
Rob Zombie is that person.
You don't get any more special.
Exactly. As soon as I said that, you know, Bob Weinstein has always got an answer. He said, Rob Zombie. And before he could finish I was like, wow, that's a perfect fit.
That really makes this film even more.
You could not ask for a better director for this film, just for the simple reason I've never in a long time that Mr. Zombie has such enthusiasm for the actual craft of filmmaking that it's infectious and it's needed. And he's the right man for this film.
Mm. He is. I mean, you know, he continually amazed me throughout the production. He's the real deal. He's an amazing director, fantastic writer. And I can't say enough good things about him. You know, I've been working in the industry for God, well over 20 years, and he's probably, you know, one of the top directors I've worked with.
What was it like? Because Rob Zombie, I assume it was a very delicate balancing act in wanting to be respectful to the Carpenter original, but also wanting to bring in his own take on the material and try to, as Zombie has said in interviews, try to kind of fill in pieces that he thought, you know, that could be kind of put into the story. So what was that balancing act like of trying to make sure that you satisfied the original fans but wanting to bring in the new fans and so forth?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, Rob, the great thing is he really had deep respect for the original.
Mm-hmm.
He knows John Carpenter. We all spoke about it, and, you know, they spoke about it, and John Carpenter was, you know, all behind it. He said, go for it. And the one thing that was important to me was that we really do something that's different. I didn't want to try and do something that was, trying to recreate John Carpenter's masterpiece, because it is, and it should stand alone on its own. And really, Rob Zombie's Halloween is a completely different movie, although you've got some the characters and some plot lines that are similar. You really can't compare the two. They're two completely different movies, and that's the way we wanted it, because I didn't want to compete with the original or even try and recreate such a classic film.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a smart plan. That's a good plan.
I'm curious, going back and forth, what was the, was there a lot of give and take on, like, you know, well, we should try to bring this element from the original, but, you know, this element you can, you know, go hog wild on and so forth. I mean, I guess an example of is, you know, the now famous, the Halloween theme music. Was that a discussion of, okay, of Zombie saying, I want to try doing my own theme, or was it always, I think we should use the Carpenter theme?
You know, it's sort of turned out to be kind of an updating of the original theme.
Right.
Or the original theme is almost as iconic as the mask, you know,
mm-hmm.
so
right.
To do it without that would be like trying to do it without the mask. And,
I agree.
You know, we had, after Bob Weinstein brought up Rob Zombie to me, we had one meeting, literally, and he came in and he pitched his idea, and he just had such a great take on it, such a great feel for it, and I felt such a great respect for the film,
mm-hmm.
the original. That was it. It was one meeting, and he was off writing his script. And his first draft that, you know, you rarely get a first draft that comes in that was that strong. We were all so excited. And, you know, we didn't set anything out in front of him and saying, can't do this, can't do that. And what he delivered was just, you know, I felt right on the money.
Mr. Akkad, this whole Halloween series has been such a significant part of your life and your father's life.
Mm-hmm.
Take me back to the beginning for just a little bit. How did your father become involved in the original picture?
He started out a company that called Compass International Pictures,
mm-hmm.
and they tried to start distributing smaller films. And he realized that it would, in the long run, it would be cheaper to make cheap films than to try and buy cheap films. So he got together with John Carpenter, and he definitely impressed him. John Carpenter impressed my father very much, and he said they can do this film for $300,000. At the time, it was called Babysitter Murders, and then after they made it, they sort of came up with this new marketing plan, or as they made it anyway, to do it called Halloween, which was just brilliant that no one had ever done that before.
I think that turned out well.
Yeah. And, you know, there were so many flukes that because they had no money, like the mask, and, you know, because they had to sort of use these long, long shots to fill the time gaps, really, but it makes it for this atmospheric film. So many of these things that they were forced to do because of the budget ended up really helping it. And then they distributed it themselves, and at the time, this company had only enough money to make two prints of the film, believe it or not. So they opened it, I think, in two drive-in theaters in Kansas City. And if of course, if it wasn't a masterpiece by John Carpenter, it never would have made it out of Kansas City, but...
Right.
Slowly the money came in and they were able to get more prints and it just spread, you know, word of mouth across the country.
What do you attribute to its success? Why do you think it caught on like it did?
You know, there's so many reasons. The music's fantastic. I think the portrayal of the characters is fantastic. I remember seeing it at a very young age and thinking, you know, wow, that's what teenagers do. You know, it's so cool. And the mask was phenomenal. I think everyone has their own imagination of what's beneath that mask.
Yeah.
And it was just so suspenseful and scary. I mean, that's really what it was.
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned the everyone has their own opinion, own vision of what's behind that mask, because I think one of the differences from what I've gathered from what I've read with this version of Halloween is that you do get a sense of where Michael comes from,
mm-hmm.
his past.
Mm-hmm.
And was there discussion, I'm sure you guys played devil's advocate at the beginning, that the Michael Myers of the original, a lot of people would argue, works so well because he is unknowable. He is
yes.
a boogeyman, an unstoppable force.
Right.
Was that a back and forth at all, or did it just flow in the script and it wasn't questionable?
You know, during the process of so many of the sequels, I mean, I can't tell you how many times we got pitched the idea of doing a prequel or a prequel slash sequel, and it just never made sense to go back and tell that story because it just you want to keep going forward.
Right.
So when we did this one, I mean, Rob's whole take on it was that he wanted to make Michael Myers a real person.
Right.
You know, as opposed to John Carpenter's, where he is sort of that the shape, the boogeyman. And so it is completely two different takes on it. And this one, you really, he's a fleshed out character that you get to know, and you get to know his background, and you see a little bit more of. So I think that that's, it's exciting, and it's a completely, like I said, different film.
It's a risk.
It is.
No, but I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean in a good way, because it's a risk worth taking.
Yeah, but that it sounds like just as terrifying a concept as the unknowable, Michael.
Yeah. I mean,
I hope so.
No, I think it's a risk worth taking, and under the right hands, it sounds like something that works. So
I didn't see a point in trying to just, like I said earlier, just recreate John Carpenter's. You know, I think John Carpenter says it all, and there's no point in trying to redo that.
Of course.
Yeah.
So when Rob's take was that he wanted to really approach this in a different way, which is exactly how I felt as well. I mean, that's where we sort of really clicked. And so I think if people are going expecting to see sort of a frame-by-frame remake of Halloween, that's definitely not what they're going to see.
No.
They're going to see something completely different.
What zombies take from what I've read, which I find more legitimate and more fascinating, and I think if the diehard fans who are sort of doing preemptive carping would think about that, this actually makes more sense in the backstory of Michael Myers than some of the sequels. You know, as you obviously know, I think, what was it, part The Curse, they tried to bring in the druid.
Oh, no.
And
yeah.
All that stuff. I mean, you know, I'm surprised, you know, fans kind of...
I think this is a smart way to do this.
Yeah.
I really do.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, I mean, you know, obviously horror fans today are a lot more sophisticated than they were in 1978. They expect a lot more. And this film is packed if you compare it to the first one. There's.
Well, I want to talk to you about the horror fans of today and the horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
It seems, you know, horror films have never kind of waned in popularity, and if they ever have, they've come right back up again from the dead, so to speak. You know, a lot of, and I know that Mr. Zombie is a major part of the revitalization of the horror genre as of late.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people criticize the genre as being, I guess they use the term, torture porn.
Right.
The Edelstein term, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this film, I know like some of the Saw and some of the Hostel and some of those films do that sort of over-the-top gore stuff. This is not like that. I can definitely tell you that.
Okay,
What I really like, what we've always tried to do anyway in Halloween, and we haven't always been successful, we've always tried anyway to make it more about the 3 minutes leading up to the kill as opposed to three minutes of killing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
that's a good point. That is very true. The Friday the 13th, you know, if you ever hear Tom Savini talk, the conference meetings were always about, okay, how can we creatively kill somebody? And that can be fun, but the Halloween films, the killings have always been rather, kind of basic, stabbing or string. But the whole cat and mouse.
Exactly.
It has always been kind of the roller coaster of it.
That's what we always try and do, this one stays true to that as well. And it's really, that's when I think the suspense is the highest, because you're sort of rooting for this character to somehow make it. And then once the kill happens, you know, then sort of any scare is gone by then.
And talk about great casting.
It's astounding, the cast.
Malcolm McDowell and a bunch of classic horror movie icons in this film, too. It's astounding.
Yeah,
he brought with a lot of his crew from this previous film.
Yeah,
good. And also you got Dee Wallace, you have Brad Dourif, and Leslie Easterbrook. I mean, Clint Howard. I mean, it's just amazing, the cast.
Well, it goes back to when I first said to Bob Weinstein, we need something special, and having Rob really helped us get a great cast. I mean, not only did he work with a lot of these people, but if he hadn't, people had heard of him, they wanted to work with him. And, so the credit there, I have to say, goes to Rob. What was interesting about Rob, and I'd never done this before, is that he likes to cast from video. He doesn't like to sit in a room And, you know, I personally find the casting process very tedious. You sit there in a room and you have actors come in, one after the other, mm-hmm. saying the same lines. So this was completely new process for me, the way he did it. And I was a bit nervous about it, but, you know, it came out beautifully. And I have to say, it's a great way of casting.
Tell me about the phone call. Who made the phone call, or how did it go about that bringing back Danielle Harris into the series, playing one of the three main girls? Because obviously Halloween fans know her from 4 and 5. What was that?
Well, I got a call from her manager, and I adore Danielle from so long ago,
right?
Part of the Halloween family, and I just told the manager that I would set up a meeting with her, and as I just said, Rob likes to watch tapes, so he saw the tape, and she stood out as someone that he really liked, and that was before he knew who she was, that she was from 5 and 6.
Oh, he didn't know she
or
was
4 and 5, excuse me.
He didn't know she was.
He didn't know that. And when he picked her as one of his, you know, favorites, I sort of took him aside and said, "Well, just so you know, this is the little girl from 4 and 5 who played a different character." And in the end, you know, it didn't matter to him, and to me, I felt great. You know, for the fans who know, they'll really like it and get a kick out of it. And she really did a fantastic job, as she always does.
I got to, on these sequels, speaking of 4 and 5, because I remember 4 coming out in Halloween of 88, and the franchise had kind of been dormant, I think, for about 5 years.
Correct.
After Season of the Witch.
Right.
My question is, and this is a personal question for you, because I know that was kind of the first one you worked on.
Yeah.
Is there one of the sequels? Because obviously they go, even the fans will say, up and down. And
of course.
But is there a sequel that you actually prefer? Because I'm actually a fan of 4, and I think 4 is actually does have some bite to it and some real suspense.
You're not alone. A lot of people love 4.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was always my father's favorite for a lot of reasons. You know, what happened with Season of the Witch, basically the series was dead in the water. As far
had a
as
great jingle though that
yeah.
that countdown jingle
was yeah great. So you know, many years later, my dad said, "Well, why not bring him back?" And everyone kind of thought he was crazy. So he bought the rights and package and got it. You know, bought the partners out anyway, and went ahead and did 4 on his own. And 4 was it was number one for 2 weeks straight in the country at the time, and it was a huge success.
That was a big deal for horror films in 88.
It was a huge success, and it was always his favorite. And then 5, which I didn't work on, but 5, they came out the very next year, which was probably too soon, and it was a much weaker film from my point of view.
It had that ESP slant to it.
Yeah.
Interesting, but it kind of...
I like the one where Jamie Lee Curtis came back.
Now, H2O is one of my favorites, definitely.
That's a great film.
Weren't there attempts made to bring John Carpenter back for that one?
Well, on and off, we've talked to him about it, but it's never, for one reason or another, it's never panned out. Mm. And it's either been
Does
scheduling
he
issues.
Does he want to come back to direct at all, like feature films?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I'm sure he's still doing feature films.
I'd camp out for that.
he is still going to do feature films, but, you know, for whatever reason, scheduling or creative conflicts or for whatever reason it is, we could never seem to get it together. But, I mean, I have such great respect for him as a filmmaker. And
absolutely.
You
know. Have you seen that?
Well, I just have one more question for you, Mr. Akai.
Sure.
Then we'll let you go. You'll be off the hook here. I know one of the greatest joys of this whole process has to be when you have the finished product and you observe the audience reaction.
Yeah.
What has some of that reaction been thus far from the advanced screenings you've attended?
Well, I have to say that the premiere was amazing. It was at the Man's Chinese in L.A., which is like, you know, the premier theater. You cannot get a better theater. And we had over 1,000 people in the audience. And right before the film, I mentioned, you know, real quick, a little tribute to my father when the whole place erupted. So that really was heartwarming.
Good.
And then during the film, I mean, the the audience were just, they were on the edge of their seats the whole time. And
what do we want to hear?
Literally people running. Some people had to leave the theater. And everyone that I knew who brought a girlfriend said, felt like they had a tourniquet on their arm, you know, girls squeezing their arms and literally getting angry at their boyfriends for taking them to it. And so that's the kind of reaction you want to hear. So the reaction so far has been amazing, and so we're very thrilled.
That's good to hear.
Yeah, Mr. Akkad, we thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's a great joy, and you're welcome back on anytime.
Great. Hope you guys enjoy the film.
I will. Thanks.
Take care. Thanks.
Bye-bye now.
Bye.
All right, that is Malik Akkad.
That was great.
Yeah, the producer of the upcoming film Halloween opens this Friday.
Does anyone here remember The Druids? The
I remember watching it in college, but that's all I can really tell you. I don't remember The Druids that specifically to that film, but
I think I brought up a bad memory when I mentioned
Druids. I think he might go home and he might, you know, drink heavily. I don't know.
I remember The Druids in Star Wars.
Oh, yes, those Druids, yes.
Those the Druids.
I would like to say something, though, and I would just like to reiterate something that a good friend of ours, Royce Clemens, wrote in his blog today. Folks, on Friday, go into this film with an open mind, really.
Yeah.
Just go in and just watch a film. And it's escapism. It's not a scene-for-scene. I hope it's not a scene-for-scene remake, but I take it that it's not.
It's not Psycho.
It's not Psycho. It's not the Omen remake. It's by Rob Zombie, who I have to say is one of the most enthusiastic filmmakers out there. And
mm-hmm.
I say that based on the interviews he did for The Devil's Rejects, which is a film that I was blown away by. I know a lot of people are probably right now have turned off the show due to that statement. But
no, I think The Devil's Rejects, I have heard nothing but from true horror fans.
It's not really even a horror movie. The opening of the film, Jamie, the first 10, 15 minutes is like you feel like you're watching Cross of Iron or The Wild Bunch. I mean, his respect for the 70s and his respect for filmmaking is shocking.
And you know that respect for the 70s plays to my heart.
Yes, I know.
Well,
I mean,
and like I was trying to point out, you know, fans that are carping about Rob Zombie, you know, trying to fill in the blanks, I mean, I prefer his more serious take than the later installments that try to, you know, graph on some type of, you know, biblical or ancient,
right.
You know,
that's a good point, Aaron.
I mean, that just, I don't know why fans weren't more upset when Druids or all that other stuff came.
Yeah.
I'm
not aware of much of that furor over the remake.
I've unfortunately read a lot of things today, Jamie, that are unfortunately of that.
Yeah, but once again, and this is where I get on my soapbox, most of this is coming. It is a very small but very obnoxiously vocal group, and this is mainly from the fanboy geek crowd who, you know, I would call the Comic-Con crowd. You know, they're very rigid in their, you know, in what they like and what they don't
Right. Well, I'm going to keep an open mind.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. And I am a big champion of Rob Zombie and the efforts that he's taken to revitalize the original Halloween
film. Oh, yeah. I'm with you.
And just to let you guys know, next Wednesday we have the actress that plays Linda in Halloween, Christina Klebe. She will be with us, and that's going to be a great conversation. I'm thinking about revealing these guests now.
I think you should. I think you really should, because I'm dying. Do you know how I've been sweating for like 2 hours now since you posted that blog?
I'm dying too.
All right. Well, let me start with this. This Sunday is the big surprise. Well, okay. Let's go ahead and spill it. This Sunday, we have booked. Can I get a fake drum roll?
Yeah, you can do it. I can't do it, but you can.
You can do it. Go ahead.
All right.
Need to get some sound effects. I know we're doing the DIY thing, but you really need to up the sound effects.
I know. Right? I know. I we need to raise our budget so we can get some cheapo sound effects. We have Richard Pink this Sunday. And who is Richard Pink?
He's the man.
You might ask. Richard Pink is the owner of Pink's Hot Dogs.
Oh, wow.
Well, you can't get better than that.
Yeah, and I know it sounds like I'm telling a joke here, but I'm not. Pink's Hot Dogs is an L.A. institution. If any of you out there have had the pleasure of eating at Pink's Hot Dogs, you know what
very
I'm
good
about.
Hot dogs.
Yeah, absolutely. But even more famous and revered for its Hollywood history, it's been around for well over 60 years. All the biggest stars of early screen and up to today frequent that place. I remember reading stories of Marlon Brando and Orson Welles eating there. And I know. And
you think they only had
I knew you were going to say that. I'm going to throw up now.
You think they only had two? I think they only ate two hot dogs.
That's not how the story went that I heard.
Okay.
So that should be a real fun, delightful, kind of delicious, you know.
I have not eaten at Pink's, but I do have a film school buddy who now lives out in L.A., and he's gone to Pink's several times, and he tells me it is worth the wait in line.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Oh,
I
yeah.
remember driving by there at 2 o'clock in the morning, and everything's kind of closed down in L.A. at that time, except for Pink's, and there was still a line a mile long.
My friends took John Milius there.
Yeah.
They would go with him all the time there.
Also, in future shows, just to let you guys know, we have the director of Canvas, Mr. Joseph Greco, confirmed for the 12th, Wednesday, September 12th. As well as the director of the upcoming documentary film Toots, Christy Jacobson, and that film kind of took Tribeca Film Festival by storm earlier this year. And we're working on a bunch of other exciting guests, too. Just keep in mind, Christina Klebe from Halloween will be on our show.
That's going to be awesome.
Next Wednesday. She's the actress that plays Linda in this updated version of Halloween.
We need to get the guy, the proprietor of the In-N-Out Burger.
You know what? The In-N-Out Burger, there's nothing better. My last trip to L.A.,
In-N-Out, and there's another place, the Apple Pan, too.
I ate there, too, yeah. Pretty much my last trip to L.A. was spent eating fattening food.
Well, let's face it, you were just trying to scope out, see if David Lynch would show up.
Yeah. Then again, all my time spent not on vacation is spent eating fatty food, too, so
yeah.
There's not really much of a difference. Are you guys ready for our next guest?
I'm very excited about our next guest.
Me too. He's acted across from some of the biggest names in the business, Mel Gibson, Jim Carrey, Christian Bale. He's been featured in one high-profile film after another, like The Patriot, What Women Want, The Butterfly Effect, The Number 23, and the hugely anticipated Western 310 to Yuma. He's even conquered the television medium with an unforgettable performance as Bobby McAllister in the fantastic series Jack and Bobby. Perhaps the most amazing aspect of his career is that it's just beginning. At the young age of 15, Logan Lerman has left an impression and built a resume that would make most stars twice his age blush with envy. His performance in the sure-to-be-classic remake 310 to Yuma has already earned him raves from Todd McCarthy and Variety, who singles out Lerman's memorable portrayal of a kid ready to skip adolescence and burst into full-blown manhood. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome this remarkable young actor to our show. Hang on real quick. I didn't hit that button right. Logan, are you there?
Hi, am I on?
Hey, you are on. Welcome to Movie Geeks United.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, it's going great. Thanks so much for calling into our show tonight.
Of course, yeah. The movie's great, and I'm dying to promote it.
We cannot wait to
see it. We're dying to see it.
Yeah,
it's
true.
It's a fantastic movie. I saw it for the first time like a week ago, and I was just in awe. It turned out so well.
Now, did you see this at a premiere or a private screening?
I saw a rough copy of before they went through editing changes and visual effects and stuff like a month ago, and it was still great. But after everything, I just saw it at the premiere and I took my best friend and family members and saw it for the first time, and it's just a fantastic movie.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it looks fantastic.
Cannot wait to see it. I want to definitely talk to you more about that movie, but first I want to. You were raised in Beverly Hills, correct?
Yep. Yeah.
Now, did you always want to enter the acting field?
I mean, actually, my family has no background really in film at all.
Yeah.
I just at a very young age just really wanted to get out of school and become an actor and just do it for the hell of it, to be in front of a camera. But luckily, I'm just so happy that I'm actually interested. Really have an interest for filmmaking now. I was a couple years ago, I just really started loving movies, and I'm a huge movie buff. I've seen everything, and I just want to make good movies now and be a part of, you know, just fantastic pieces of art, and that's what I love.
Now. Well, what kind of movies that you've seen have inspired you the most in your craft?
Well, I mean, I haven't done enough yet to really, you know, express my, you know, artistic style.
Yeah.
But, you know, movies, God, I love everything. I love, you know, Michel Gondry stuff, you know, the Spike Jonze stuff, Wes Anderson, you know, just really abstract.
Oh, this guy's got great taste.
Yeah, of course. But, you know, the all-time best, in my opinion, is definitely Kubrick.
Definitely. Oh, wow.
Thank you. No offense, Jamie, but
I know. Oh, is this an argument going on?
It is. And it is a long argument, and I don't want to cut into your interview.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I mean, I just love him. He's definitely, he's the best.
I'll go see every film you're in for the rest of my life.
Thank you.
Would you have been willing to do one of those one or 18-month shoots, one-year shoots of Kubrick?
You know, I would do anything to work with that guy.
Yeah.
Anything. I just think he's so amazing in his filmmaking. You know, every film, there's something so unique about it in his style. He's just such an amazing filmmaker, and I just aspire to be like him someday.
Yeah. Well, your first film was The Patriot, and that was in 2000, correct?
Yeah.
And that was an amazing movie. How did that break come about for you?
I mean, honestly, I barely remember anything back then. I mean, I was just really young. I was just a little guy. I just wanted to be in filmmaking just for fun. I didn't really have that much of a creative interest in it. You know, just recently I've acquired that interest, and I really want to be a director someday. It's what I really am mostly interested in. I really want to be a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, acting is a lot of fun, and I really enjoy it, but filmmaking is what I really like.
Do you find that because you've worked with such sensational directors, Joel Schumacher and Penny Marshall and James Mangold, have you observed them closely, and have you noticed a real difference in the way all of them direct actors?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Every movie I work on, you know, I just learn so much from who I'm working with. You know, 310, which is coming out, it was just, you know, an honor. When I first found out that I was going to audition for it, you know, they told me it's a James Mangold movie, and, you know, Faden and Papa Michael's going to be, you know, the DP, and I just, you know, went crazy and said I had to do it because they're amazing filmmakers, one of the best out there right now. Both of them, like, they're a great team.
Well, you've been doing this a long time. I'm curious, those early films, like you said, when you were little, like The Patriot and What Women Want, you know, now that you're getting, you know, more mature, can you go back and watch those films objectively, or are those kind of like, you know, seeing old home movies where, you know, certain films I just can't watch because I'm, you know.
I mean, those movies are great. Like, yeah. I mean, I enjoy them, but I honestly just can't watch them and look at myself. It's hard for me to look at my performances in movies. I'm very critical.
Right.
Yeah, but you know, it's a fun way to document your childhood, I guess, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes.
But I'm fortunate in the fact that I didn't, you know, grow up like most of those actor kids that like went to like homeschooling programs and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I never really had the full-on experience. Like, I'm just some, you know, any kid that just wanted to do it for fun and actually, you know, have
right.
a chance to really do great movies, big stuff, and actually make it on the screen, which is great.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, about being a teenage actor working in Hollywood. Now, how does, just from the mechanics of it, how does your schooling work out?
Schooling? I go to a regular school, and whenever I am working, I have an amazing, amazing teacher that follows me around everywhere, wherever I work, and, you know, she always, you know, helps me with everything, and basically she takes care of everything for me and talks to the school and works out, you know, situations with homework and stuff, and I do school on set when I can, you know, I have to do at least 3 hours a day.
Right.
It's a lot harder to have to do school while you're working because tend to get into what I'm working on, and it's hard to break, you know, from character and have to do math or something.
Right.
What do your classmates or and your friends think of your success?
Well, I've known these kids so long that we don't really, you know, look at it as anything. You know, I don't really see myself as being very successful, like, because they just don't even bring it up. It's just like I go shoot a movie, and it's successful, and other people see it, but we never really bring it up. We're just still hanging out, and the same kid, you know, kids we've been hanging out with for like the past, you know, 10 years or whatever. Just we don't really focus on it at all.
That's great. That's great. I want to talk to you about 310 to Yuma. Now, this is a remake of a very good film.
Yes.
From about 50 years ago. Were you encouraged to watch that original film, or did you check it out before embarking on this one?
Of course. I mean, you have to see it if it's a remake.
Yeah.
Obviously, I like the new one, you know, way more because they actually, you know, boosted up my role, and I actually have a major part in the film now.
Yeah.
As in the old one, my role was like only in like the first like 20 minutes or something, 15 minutes, and then you never see him again.
Right.
Right. That's
and in the new one, it's really great.
So tell me a little bit about your character.
Well, the movie is centered around, you know, Dan Evans, played by Christian Bale, who's just one of the best actors out there right
now. Amen to that.
Yes, he's amazing, and learning from him is amazing, but that's a whole different story. But he plays a rancher who's in debt and agrees to take this captured outlaw to a train to jail so he can, you know, pay off his debt and save his family. And I play his son, who just doesn't think he's really trying hard enough and not putting, you know, enough effort in trying to save his family. And there's a whole tension between the two of us throughout the whole movie, and it's kind of a coming of age story for me, trying to find out like what path I want to go in when I meet Russell Crowe's character, who is the outlaw. You know, which direction do I want to take, kind of a thing. It's a really interesting movie. I mean, the storyline is you know, it's a pretty simple storyline, but what really makes it great is the performances and the and how everybody really brings something to the screen and really,
yeah,
you know, makes this movie special.
It's got to be special with this cast and this director at the helm.
Oh yeah,
Christian Bale and Russell Crowe.
That's quite a combo. And Peter Fonda too.
I gotta
ask, you know, for as much as you've accomplished, you know, you've worked with some pretty intense actors. I mean, Mel Gibson, you know, Russell Crowe and Jim Carrey, Christian Bale, Peter Fonda. I mean, and so those guys, you know, they don't, the impression that they don't, you know, really take their craft lightly, and they can be pretty intense and on set and so forth. So what's it like being around that kind of, you know, high level? I mean, just the fact, you know, Russell Crowe and Christian Bale, I mean, those two guys, I mean, you just imagine them going at it together. So what's it like witnessing those two guys going at it?
I mean, just being allowed, you know, to be in a room with great actors such as, you know, Christian Bale and Russell and even Ben. I think Ben Foster is
a great actor too.
Oh, Alpha,
you know,
Dog.
He's very up and coming.
Yeah.
I mean, if not, you know, he's very successful right now too.
Mm-hmm.
But just to be allowed to be in a room with them and act with them is just an honor. But the first time I worked with them, with Russell, you know, I got kind of nervous, but I realized you just have to do your own thing, and everybody has their own method, and of course you can pick up on things, and I learned a lot from the people that I've worked with, which is, you know, very great people, very great actors, and very people that are really great at their profession, but you really got to do it the way that you're most comfortable. So for me, it's just, you know, I didn't really think about I didn't really think like about working with these guys that are getting paid like $20 million a picture. I just thought of them as their characters and just kind of work with them through that kind of aspect of it, not really of who they are, but their characters in the movie.
Oh yeah, and there's a reason why they get paid what they do, because
they're amazing.
Yeah. They're extraordinary. They're the most extraordinary talents we have on film.
Of course.
I have a movie geek. I'm sorry.
I got one quick question about on you did the number 22 with Jim Carrey, which was kind of a change of pace for him, you know, one of his more serious films.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just as a fan of Jim Carrey and all his work, I'm just curious, what was that set like? Was he you know, between scenes, was he kind of more loose, or did he kind of stay kind of in the intense mode, or was he able to kind of break loose between scenes?
I mean, that has to be the most, I mean, he's one of my favorite actors, too. I think he's amazing. I think he's totally underrated for being a dramatic actor. Like, people really don't realize that he's this amazing dramatic talent.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people just think of him as, you know, just some comedic actor. It's really not true.
The dramatic roles that are better.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I personally love him more as a dramatic actor. But, you know, it was definitely the highlight of my life to be able to work with him, and I learned the most from him. He was totally cool. In that movie, he didn't really get too much into his character, so he can break free, you know, most of the time when he wanted to. And,
mm-hmm.
I was with him for months, like 3 months straight, and it was mostly just me and him a lot, and, you know, Virginia Madsen.
Who's also amazing.
Oh, also
yeah.
Amazing actress, totally. And, and he knew that I'm, like, one of his biggest fans, and I love his movies. And he'd just sit down with me for, you know, a couple hours and just talk to me about everything that happened on these movies that I admire, like, you know, Man on the Moon and Truman Show. And he'd just tell me how he made them and, you know, what he was going through and what he did and, like, how stupid he was at times and how he got into a character. And that's how I really learned, you know, how to really get into a character and really, you know, become, you know, who you're playing. You know, I'm dying to really be able to, you know, take advantage of that and of what I've learned and really put it, you know, forth to, you know, have it and use it for a role.
Absolutely.
But it was just one of the best learning experiences I've ever had.
I have to ask you a movie geek question because
this
is Movie Geeks United. You're working with Christian Bale. Now, did you press him for any details on the new Batman film?
You know, I didn't want to, like, hassle him. I didn't want to, like, do... Like,
I wouldn't want to hassle him.
Like,
I understand.
You know, crazy fan thing, you know, because I'm a huge fan of Batman and Christopher Nolan movies and everything.
Yeah.
So, I was, he didn't really, you know, give away too much, but he just said that the movie is going to be, you know, amazing and that I think right after we finished, he had to, like, fly to England to, like, improve the bat suit or something.
Gotta do that.
Man. But, yeah.
Well, I mean, what's it like? I mean, it's kind of, it must have been kind of, you must have flipped out. I mean, Christian Bale's playing your father.
I mean,
that's kind of weird.
Just for anybody to think that I remotely look like Christian Bale is awesome. But I can be his son. All right. That's cool.
Now, I understand that you make short films. So directing is something that you eventually do want to take on?
Oh, yeah. I really want to be a filmmaker. My best friend and I really, you know, we work together and we make our little homemade movies. I'm surprised you guys know that. You guys, wow, cool. We make little short films together and we post them on YouTube. But, you know, the ones that we post on YouTube are mostly just like our little stupid ones that we make for fun. Like the ones that we really put time into, they're too long to put on YouTube.
Right.
Because they have like a 10-minute like time limit and we didn't want to, like, shorten our file down to, like, something and, like, split it up and stuff. So, yeah, I really do want to be a filmmaker.
Wow.
Kubrick
is the one you most look up to.
Oh, yeah. He's the best. He
that's
is the best.
That's a great
and
role model.
There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
There's no argument there. He just is.
That's right.
There
is no argument.
I won't argue with you. I promise.
Sure.
We'll save that for another show. Logan, I wish you the best of luck.
Yeah,
and
thank you very much.
This movie
thank
has
you.
A sneak preview, 3:10 to Yuma sneak preview Sunday evening, correct?
Yeah, while we're on the air.
Yes, Sunday evening. And then it opens the following Friday, correct?
That's correct, and everybody go see it.
We'll make sure that they do.
I'll be there as soon as I can.
Oh, yeah.
I would be there Sunday, but I have prior obligations.
Yeah.
We'll do a live broadcast.
I'll try that, and I might get thrown out, too.
From
oh,
the
yeah.
theater, that'll be great.
Logan, definitely worth seeing. It's a great movie.
Logan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very
hey, thank
much.
Thank you. Hey, it was nice meeting you. Hey,
you're welcome back anytime.
All right. Have a
bye-bye
good
bye-bye now. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Fantastic young actor there. Remarkable career, and he's just gotten started. Expect big, big things from that young man. Logan Lerman, 3:10 to Yuma, film sneak previews this Sunday evening at theaters across the country. And then it opens on the following Friday. It's,
that's right.
It's going to be remarkable.
That's got to be crazy. I mean, you're working with, you're in a scene with Russell Crowe and Christian Bale. I don't, you know, I don't think, I wouldn't be able to do much acting. I'd be so in
awe. I know,
in
awe the whole time.
Just watching them, yes. Yeah. I think we have a call here, and we probably had a call during that last guest tonight. Didn't see it. Let me bring him up.
Okay.
817 area code. Go right ahead.
Hey, guys. This is John.
Hey, John. I'm sorry. How long have you been on hold?
Oh, it's quite all right. I'm not available at the computer, so I was able to hear Logan. You know, it's nothing funnier to me than the reality that a 15-year-old can say, all I really want to do is direct. That's greatness. Born in Beverly Hills.
I was saying it when I was 15, and I was born in, you know, Podunk, Florida.
Oh, nothing
wrong
with
it. I was saying it when I was fucking 8 years old, but...
There you go.
Well, there goes no cursing rule on our show.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. But he's off the air, okay?
Yeah, but Jamie, he wanted to be David Lynch, not Kubrick.
Yeah, I really wanted to. I really wanted to ask him if, you know, Drew Barrymore gave him some tips when he was in writing with Cars with Boys on how to really throw the career away at a young age, or what not to do.
Actually,
she got it.
It's a good thing we didn't take John's call.
No, I forgot.
You didn't like riding the car with boys.
I didn't have a problem with it. I thought that James Woods was in a great performance in a mediocre movie. I think Penny Marshall really.
I think if James Woods wasn't in the movie, I might have walked out.
And imagine it as an autobiography of Drew Barrymore. They would have run out of cars and boys.
There you go.
You guys are harsh, man.
They would have had to go on to trucks and girls.
Right.
Oh, man, you guys are harsh. If we ever get Drew Barrymore, we're going to hell.
All right, there's one word for Drew Barrymore. One word. Sporadic.
I just don't understand, when the news...
I am a huge Drew Barrymore. I think Fever Pitch is one of the great romantic comedies of the last...
You're gonna argue against Kubrick, but you're going to be for Drew Barrymore, really?
Here's my thing. I love Kubrick, but... my thing with Drew Barrymore, I have nothing against her. I just, when this news came out, like all this news that everyone was so shocked by her behavior, I was just like, her last name, folks. It's the Barrymore legacy. Give her a break, okay?
I thought Letterman was a very lucky man.
What was that?
I thought Letterman was a very lucky man.
Well, there you go. I mean, yeah.
You know, this is an odd conversation. We're talking Kubrick and Drew Barrymore. It's like a couple of weeks ago when we hypothesized what it would be like if Kubrick directed Friday the 13th.
You would have had a million takes of him coming out of Camp Crystal Lake. That's what you would have had.
You would have had like five people playing Jason because no one could. Hey, I got to go back to the hardware store. Okay, I can't stay here this long.
You're not wearing the mask right. That would have been hysterical.
It would have been 3 hours.
Yeah.
But by virtue of it is worth considering, because personally I think Kubrick's overrated. But I'm with people. I understand why people love him.
I think Bottled Water's overrated.
And bottled water is not necessarily clean, pure water.
No, it's just out of tap out of the YMCA across the street from us.
Yeah,
but
just
okay.
Like Kubrick is, you know, people think he is, but he's not necessarily a great director. But my point about Kubrick is, if he would have directed something like Friday the 13th, would people just automatically, because it's a Kubrick film, rave about it? Like it's an all-time classic time vault art museum piece.
Well,
it depends on the argument. Is the argument the movie is the exact same movie it is now, except
yes.
Kubrick directed it? Okay. Well, that would be different. I mean, I don't know. When it comes to Kubrick, it's obviously not his style. But, yeah, I mean, a lot of people are always going to be slanted towards, the previous work. Look at Eyes Wide Shut. I mean, the movie really was awful. I'm sorry. It was awful, but I love Kubrick. But
yeah. It was one of two Kubrick movies that I liked.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, it's a different
yeah,
opinion.
Yeah, right there, you might as well. It's the only Kubrick film that has a happy ending.
But look for Logan to look up to Kubrick. I mean, honestly, you can't ask for a better role model as a director. I am envious of Kubrick for his place in the industry, how he made movies, how he was able to spend so much time with minimal crew, minimal budget,
and the studio let him do whatever he wanted.
Well, I mean, that's power.
Yeah. Only Woody Allen has that kind of power. Yeah. It sounds ridiculous.
And Lucas.
And Clint Eastwood.
Right.
Lucas paid for his own movies.
And Clint, and Clint Eastwood has a similar deal with Warner Brothers. He can pretty much do what he wants within his budget.
Yeah. But they told him, they at first told him no for Unforgiven, and they told him no for Million Dollar Baby, and they told him no for Mystic River. He had to fight Warner Brothers, his home.
Well, I think that was because of Blood Work. Also, you know, it's like each film
boxing movies don't gross anything.
That's true.
Yeah.
And, just look at Resurrecting the Champ.
And Downers don't gross anything either. That was the argument against Mystic River. It's like such a downer. But
it is a downer. It's no doubt about that.
But if it's Oscar bait, if there ever was.
Yeah, no, there is Oscar bait. No, but I think, you know, Kubrick, since he's not already, it's Woody Allen, George Lucas, and Mel Gibson can do whatever they want because they have the money. They have their own money.
Mel Gibson still can do what he wants?
I think Mel Gibson can do whatever. You know what? Let me tell you this, and I know a lot of people are going to, I'm going to get hate mail. Well, I don't get hate mail. I wish I got hate mail. I wish I got any kind of mail. But Mel Gibson, because can do whatever he wants, still.
Yeah. Well, he's worth, you know,
he's worth
$600.
What is the gross of Passion of Christ? That's what he's worth.
It's one, yeah. It's one of the, well, and more than that, because he's been working in the business 30 years prior.
Yeah.
But Passion of the Christ is one of the, like, 10 to 15 top grossing movies of all time, entirely financed by Gibson and
yeah, if that movie didn't do well, it would be a different story, but because that movie brought in so much money, and because he was able to do something, what was the last movie those people had seen? They hadn't been in the movie theater in 20-odd years. E.T. was the last movie most of those people had seen in the theater. I'm not making this up, folks.
You're wrong. It was My Big Fat Greek Wedding.
No, they didn't come out for that. And let's talk about that. God, that woman, Nina Varadalis, she killed that TV show she made.
So I took $10 in debit from
All right, John, tell us about Dead Air Show this Sunday.
This Sunday we are going to do a little bit of Reader's Theater. We're going to go over the Alberto Gonzalez resignation a little bit, just mainly by reading the goofy blog I posted on my personal page.
I like that.
The phone call. Thank you. I appreciate it. And, basically we're in a free form. I think I got some information from a Mr. Jamie Duvall about having you guys on, so we would love to do that.
We really want to destroy the reputation of your show. I have bad news for the next 2 weeks, though.
Oh, what's that?
We had to schedule ourselves at 7 because 6 o'clock was full.
So my dad is going to call in for me, and God help you all.
We'll do a little bit of I'll do some backstage information because it doesn't make for great radio, but I'll send you some information on getting your time slot back. You can get it back.
Oh, good.
Well, thank you, John.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Not
John.
A problem.
And
but,
we will tune in on Sunday, definitely, and I'll talk to you real soon.
Hey, we love the show. We're glad to be able to do some cross promotion. www.thedeadairshow.com. Thanks, guys, so much.
Absolutely, thank
Kubrick
you.
Kubrick rocks.
It's That's great. The Dead Air Show every Sunday at 7 o'clock. Great show. Listen
Those
to
guys
that
rule.
Listen to that definitely on replay and listen to us.
I gotta ask, what is the other good Kubrick movie according to you?
Clockwork Orange. Okay. Jerry, you have one more. You have something that you want to share.
I want to have something to say, but the current events, the way the internet moves, I'm going to say, I got like, 3 minutes?
First of all, let me say thank you very much to Tiffany Littleton, our on-air announcer. We just got profiled in the paper here, and you can actually see a video clip of us conducting the show and look for that
clip.
Link on our websites. Go ahead, Jerry.
Yeah, we had earlier, over the weeks, we have two very important members, people who called into our show, film critics from MySpace, Tony Farinella and Tony DeFrancisco, have left MySpace. Now, as of the hour before the show, Tony Farinella is back on MySpace. But I just wanted to say that these two guys, their enthusiasm for film, their friendship, their kindness, they add a lot to the show. I hope they'll call back in again. Like Jeremy and Royce Clemens, and we've had so many great people from MySpace call in. You guys have really, you made the show what it is. We would
Absolutely.
Be lost without all of you.
Absolutely. Our base
I really need to say that it's the only fan community I've ever been part of, but it's the only fan community that I've seen works.
Yeah. And
we owe all of you everything for our success.
They're so generous
and, every
and
one of
welcoming
them.
And great writers and great analysts of film and we want them on MySpace badly.
Right.
And I'm glad to hear that we got him back.
Yeah.
So great show tonight.
Wonderful show.
I think so too. Let's take the last 30 seconds and just pat ourselves on the back.
Sounds good to me.
Aaron, it was a great treat to have you on the show tonight.
Yes, thank you.
I look forward to it again.
You will be back, definitely. And Chris will be back with the Movie Geeks on Sunday night for another great, great show.
That'll be an awesome show.
And I will talk to you guys later on.
Okay.
Good night, everybody.
All right, good night, everyone. Thanks.
Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.